The limit of government power is defined by the limits of our obedience. That doesn't speak well of the future of Australia, because the gap between what you cost your employer versus the purchasing power you get left with. This is the single metric that I think is the most important one for us to measure in housing, in the entire economy, the cost of living, the cost of everything.
Today, we have a unique character. He's a best-selling author, most awarded libertarian in Australia, and his content has been reposted twice by the Elon Musk.
What is it that has so many people on the wrong side of history, to put it into your words?
Ignorance of history is a big part of it, but there's also a very powerful normalcy bias where...
Do you believe that the real estate crisis in Australia is a natural market failure, or is it a consequence of government interference?
Let me throw a scary number at you.
If the odds are stacked so against us and people aren't waking up, the realization or the potential dangers, why do what you do?
Two reasons.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. Today we have a unique character here with us today. His name is Topher Field. A lot of you guys may know him. I actually mentioned it to my wife, and my wife was like, I've been following this guy since COVID. And I'm like, interesting, I got to do some research now because I haven't been following you. So Topher, thank you very much for being with us here today. Topher is a magnet for controversy, right? He's a multi-award winning director in Australia. He's a best-selling author, most awarded libertarian in Australia. And his content has been reposted twice by the Elon Musk, which is pretty cool, if you ask me.
That was so crazy. It was twice in the same month, which makes it even more crazy.
Yeah,
I haven't been able to back it up since, though. I don't know what I'm doing wrong, you know?
But that's a bit of a mic drop, if you ask me. You know, if you're getting your content reposted by the smartest and most powerful and wealthiest man in the universe.
I do wonder how Barack Obama feels about Elon Musk being the world's most powerful African American, though. That'd be a bit hard for him to wrap his head around.
Did you mention controversy magnet?
Yeah, I think so. And we're off.
Yeah, we are.
James, thank you very much, as usual.
Yeah, welcome. This will be an interesting one. Like yourself, I had to do a quick bit of research. Purely the name, name itself sparked some interest. So I jumped on and had a bit of a run, and GPTs kept going and going and going. I was like, oh, fuck, this could be a long podcast.
Yeah. And Mark, thank you very much.
No worries.
I know that you've been following Topher on X for quite some time.
Since the Elon Musk repost. What I find interesting is that I think a lot of what you post is common sense, right? I deem it to be common sense, but it seems to blow up and become controversial. So maybe we can talk more about that now. And maybe you've got a cheeky side to you. And sometimes to get your message out there, you need to be a little bit like that. But
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Let's go for it.
Well, I love what you're doing because, you know, you've increased your following on YouTube, your subscribers, by 50,000 since the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And we've been going now for about 18 months, and we're continually growing, and we understand the difficulty of gaining a subscriber on YouTube. And you're doing really well with that, and you're doing so well with your merch, including your book sales. And you've created a business out of this now.
Speaking of which, I brought one for each of you. Awesome. I figured you probably wouldn't have them. So take one, pass it on. The old schoolyard.
Awesome.
The classroom thing.
Appreciate that.
And so that's my first book that became an Amazon bestseller in the category of human rights. This is about civil disobedience in the modern age, and the fact that the only thing that actually limits government power is the people reaching the limit of their obedience.
And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So this book, like, if this doesn't grab your attention, the name of the book, the title of the book, is Good People Break Bad Laws. Like, that is very, very interesting and an intriguing title, if you ask me. But we're going to be talking about a few different things. And a couple of the topics we're going to be talking about today is the limits of government power. We're going to be dabbling a little bit into economics. And something that Topher has a strong belief on is the need for return of in-person community. And he'll explain what he means by that. And also dabble a little bit into the nomad capitalist genre. So where do we start?
Oh, goodness. Let's start at the very beginning. I mean, good people break bad laws. It's exactly what you said, Mark. I view that as just perfect common sense. I don't think of that as being in any way controversial or clickbaity. I'm not trying to rile anybody up, and yet it does. I've got it on my, you know, my t-shirts and my hoodies. And the funny thing is, other people say to me, oh, I could never wear that. Like, I love your stuff, but have you got other designs? And yes, I do, in case you're wondering. But I could never wear that. It'd be too controversial. I've only ever had positive responses to this down the street. No one has ever said anything negative about it, which is quite interesting. But the simple fact is, if you look back in history, history can be described as a power struggle, essentially, between the people that want to rule over others and the people that just want to rule themselves, right? That's that, broadly speaking, you could view in the entirety of history just through that lens. And the only thing that has ever worked to actually stop people from taking excessive power over others is when those others stop obeying. And we've tried everything. We've tried every form of government. Almost every form of government that's been tried has been some form or other, some attempt at limiting government power, whether that's in the form of a constitutional monarchy as opposed to an absolute one, whether that's in the form of a republic, whether that's various Westminster or democratic systems, whether it's with bills of rights. We've tried all these different mechanisms. And essentially what we're trying to do is draw a box around the government and say, you're not allowed to get out of that box.
Some people would say that the only thing that works is having guns. And you know, as reference to America, but you wouldn't get much support or love on that.
I wholeheartedly agree with that point of view, because the ultimate expression of disobedience, when push really comes to shove, is that shove comes to shooting. I mean, that is ultimately where this, and I don't want anyone to get there. There's nothing less civilized than a civil war. That's one of the most uncivilized things you could possibly imagine. And yet, without the knowledge that it can get to that, governments get very, very punchy very, very quickly. But Australians don't really want to hear that, by and large. We don't really want to think about that. Australia has this curse of having been the lucky country. Now, the lucky country was a book that was actually written that wasn't a compliment. It was actually telling us, you guys are lazy. You guys are riding off the back of good luck. Good luck of geography, good luck of weather, good luck of industry and politics, having been colonized by the British as opposed to being colonized by others. You guys are the lucky country. And if you don't wise up real quick, your luck's going to run out. And you guys aren't going to know what hit you, because you've never actually had to navigate anything bad. And the reality is, decades after that book was written, it remains true. You think about the global financial crisis. You think about the Asian financial crisis. You think about all of these things. We were really largely untouched by all of those things.
We benefited, if anything.
If anything, yeah. And in a lot of cases, Australians actually just now think this is our birthright. This is the default, this level of prosperity, this lifestyle, this is the default condition of mankind. And nothing could be further from the truth. A little bit of travel will tell you that real quick. But because we've become complacent, we're not paying enough attention to what our government is doing. And this comes back full circle back to government power. So how do you stop the government from destroying your country, from taking total power and doing to it what was done in the USSR, what was done in North Korea, what was done in Venezuela, example after example, Zimbabwe, look at South Africa right now. These are all just examples of what happens when a government takes too much control, too much power over a given society. The only thing in history that has ever worked long term is the people reaching the limit of their obedience. Now, ideally, non-violently, but if that option isn't there, then the government knows that they can just keep pushing harder and further.
What would you say to me saying that I think we're miles off that point, either peacefully or violently here in Australia?
I would say, unfortunately, the most recent election would suggest that you're right. The fact that Daniel Andrews got re-elected in Victoria after becoming the worst human rights abuser in modern Australian history would suggest that you're absolutely correct. I made a promise to myself when I was in Venezuela in 2015 that I would not be that man who saw what was coming down the pipeline, understood the moment in history that they were in, and failed to get their family out. There are people who say, oh, you can't leave. I left Victoria. I moved out of Victoria. And there were people saying to me, you can't leave Victoria. You have to stay here and fight. And I'm saying, well, I'm trying to patch the holes in the bottom of the boat, but there's 1,000 people all around me with sledgehammers making them bigger. Mm. Like, I'm sorry, I can't fix stupid. I'm not the idiot whisperer. I can't, a horse whisperer can go up to a wild, unbroken horse and kind of whisper to it and change its mind and everything. I'm not the idiot whisperer. I can't do that, right? If I'm surrounded by idiots, there comes a point where you just go, okay, idiots, have your idiot ways. You're going to get what you want. And that's not a blessing. That's a curse. You're getting what you want so often in life. You're going to get what you want, and I'm going to go somewhere else to build for my family what I want to give them.
So you know, this is a question that I was going to ask as well, is if the odds are stacked so against us and people aren't waking up to the realization or the potential dangers that we're facing, why do what you do?
Two reasons. August Landmesser, a name that you may not know, but I promise you've seen his face. August Landmesser. If you listen to the podcast, Google him now, and a picture will come up. And that picture is going to be a black and white picture of a whole bunch of dock workers in the 1930s, after Hitler came to power in Germany, but before the war had started. And Hitler was consolidating his power, and everyone was becoming a member of the Nazi Party. It was the fashionable thing to do. Let's not forget, he was the 1936 Time magazine Man of the Year. He had the greatest games on earth that was celebrated worldwide, the greatest Olympics that had ever been. He was regarded as an example for the world. That's not me talking. That's history talking. That was that moment in history. And there's a photograph of these dock workers, and they're all doing the Hitler salute. And there's one dude standing there with his arms folded across his chest. Right? We've all seen that photo at some point in time. We've all seen this photo. That man's name was August Landmesser. He folded his arms across his chest because he would not, even just to fit in, even just to not stand out, even just to not create waves and ripples, he would not make this the outward symbol of obedience to the rising Hitler regime. He did not know that there was a camera there. He did not know that that photograph was going to sit in someone's attic for a couple of decades before being rediscovered, investigated, and his name would eventually come to the surface in history. He did not know that he was going to become a symbol of the fact that even at the time, there were people who did the right thing, not all Germans. He became a symbol for that. When Tank Man stood in front of that column of tanks in Tiananmen Square in China, he didn't know that a mile behind him was a CNN crew on top of a skyscraper building with a telephoto lens that was going to get photographs and video of him, and that he would be immortalized in history as Tank Man, as the man who stopped a column of tanks with his shopping in his hand. He was literally on his way home from the shops. He wasn't even a protester. He's got bags of shopping in his hand, and he saw something, and he went, nah. Nah, not having it. And he didn't do it for the cameras. He didn't do it for history. He did it because it was right. So all the way through, and I mean, we unfortunately can't have a podcast without talking about what happened in COVID, at least briefly. I was one of the very first people to speak up against the lockdowns and the government, total government control that was taken during that time. And a lot of people said to me, it's pointless. Why are you doing this to yourself? I ended up on criminal charges, cost my family tens of thousands of dollars, a lot of sleepless nights, destroyed my mental health. I lost my business through it all. It came at a terrible cost. And people would say to me, why are you doing this? You're not going to change anything. It's not about whether or not I change anything. It's about the fact that I, for the rest of my life, know that when my test came, I passed, right? When history asked me the question, who are you? You know, we've all asked ourselves the question, if I'd been alive in the 1930s in Germany, who would I have been? And we all want to believe that come the late 1930s and 40s, we would have been the one hiding Anne Frank. We all want to believe that. If we'd been in France, we want to believe that we would have been the one in the resistance, not the one who was making business deals with the Vichy regime. We all want to believe that we would have been on the right side of history. Most of us never get the opportunity to find out. We live such wonderful, luxurious, prosperous lives. Most of us never get the chance to actually find out who we would have been. I was given that chance. And I have proved to myself beyond a shadow of doubt who I am and who I would have been during that time. And for me, that's worth everything I lost. There is no price that you can possibly put on that.
What gave you the confidence to do that? Because there'd be a lot of people that would be thinking the same thing, right?
That's not worth sticking the neck out.
Correct. Yeah. What was the difference?
So I ended up doing, because I get asked this question so much, I ended up doing a masterclass essentially on mental health and on mentality. And one of those weeks is dedicated to the issue of courage. Because people said, oh, well, how did you have the courage to keep going out there in front of the armored cars and the riot squad and getting hit with tear gas and threats and all the rest? Like, there was physical danger as well as legal peril. How did you have the courage to keep doing that? And the reality is courage doesn't actually exist in the way that we think it does. See, courage, we think of it as a feeling like love, right? We sort of put it in the, yeah, you can have courage, you can have love, you can have fear, you can have this. No, courage doesn't exist like that. Talk to anyone that's, you know, we've all seen the interview, someone runs into a burning building and rescues a baby or does something in that moment. And the reporter goes, oh, you know, wow, that was so incredibly courageous. Where did you find the courage? And they'll look at the reporter and go, what courage? I just did what I had to do. I just did what needed to be done. Courage exists only in the moment of action, and it's not a feeling. Courage emerges naturally. Courage simply appears when you have an individual who knows what their values are and can see those values being violated, and has an identity that requires them to do something about it. Where you get people with bravado is people who they might have the values and say, oh, that's wrong, da 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 da, but their identity allows them to skulk off into the weeds.
The I agree with a lot of what you're saying. The thing that I struggle to wrap my head around is that I find that having some of the points of views that we have here on this panel, whether it be in relation to lockdowns, COVID, the political leader, economics, you're in the minority.
Oh yeah.
And so it's not like the people who are watching this on the other side of the debate will look at you, will look at us and look at you and say, this guy's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about, because I disagree with everything he's saying anyway.
Sure.
What is it? What is it with the people that you mentioned before that got captured on those photos? What is it with the people that are standing up against what they feel like is a country or a society moving in the wrong direction? What is it that separates them from the crowd? Because like my day job is investing and trading, right? And so I get paid to be contrarian. Like if too many people have my view, it's time to start. It's time to start exiting, right? Yeah. So I win when I'm against the crowd. And so being against the crowd is a place that I'm comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place that I like being. But what is it that, is it the study of history? Like what is it that has so many people on the wrong side of history, to put it into your words, or unawares of the ramifications of what's really unfolding?
Ignorance of history is a big part of it. But there's also a very powerful normalcy bias where people assume that the world, when it deviates from what they're used to, they assume that it's a temporary thing and it will snap back. And it takes 10, 15, 20 years for people to realize, oh, hang on, this isn't going to snap back. This isn't going to come back. But also our perception of who we are and where we live and what this place is like is already 20 years out of date as we grow up, because our perception is mostly shaped by the people around us telling us, oh, we live in Australia. This is a free country. Our Anzacs fought for our freedom. You're lucky you were born in Australia. Okay. Now that's true. But that was true when you were a kid and you were raised with that, and that sort of gets frozen in time, and you carry that forward with you over time, and it's going to take, it's easier to fool somebody than it is to convince them that they've been fooled. It takes a lot to change somebody's mind from the thing they were raised with. And so it's going to take you until you're 40, maybe 50, to really sit there and go, hold on a second. We are not the same country that we were when I was a kid. That's just a natural, that's just naturally how long that tends to take. There were some really striking things about the groups that were protesting, though. There were two groups that were noticeably overrepresented amongst the protesters. These are the people willing to actually go toe-to-toe with the police, get tear gas, get beat up, get arrested, all that sort of stuff. Eastern Europeans, first and second generation migrant Eastern Europeans from former communist countries, very identifiable, very overrepresented group as a proportion of the population. Why? Because they knew what they were looking at. They got it. They understood. They weren't sitting there with this lazy Australian, and I can say that because I'm fifth generation Australian, this lazy Australian prosperity, she'll be right. It's always been good, so therefore it will always be good, normalcy bias that we have. They sat there and said, we know how bad it can get. We fled, or my dad told me the stories about what he fled, or my mum, about what they fled, and I'm looking and I'm saying, this is happening here. And they understand that it can happen here.
Yeah, so you've sort of mentioned Venezuela, and mentioned we're not going to sit on COVID for too long, but, and you had a fairly large display of your freedom of speech with COVID.
Yeah.
What's the current now mission? What's the current new COVID that you're pushing forward that we should all be aware of? And what, we're like the frog in the pot.
Yeah.
We're slowly, slowly, but what is the new threat you see that's ruining our country, as you said?
So we are heading down an economic pathway that is far closer to Venezuela than most Australians are willing to admit. Now, I've been saying this since 2015 when I came back from Venezuela. I got laughed at the time, and I listed five specific things to look for. Five specific things that when I was in Venezuela, I went, okay, I get it now. I see what's destroyed this country.
What's happening in Venezuela for the people that don't know?
Ah, okay. Yeah, fantastic.
What are those five things?
Okay, so in the 1990s, Venezuela was the wealthiest country per capita in South America, and has been among the wealthiest in the world for a long time. You go back to roughly when Australia was the wealthiest per capita in the world, about 120 odd years ago, Venezuela was up there as well.
And this is based on their rich resources?
Rich resources, correct. So
similar to
gold, gemstones, tropical growing climate, beautiful tourism opportunities. I mean, what a stunning part of the world. It is fabulous. It
really
is. The largest proven heavy oil reserves, I think it's heavy oil in their case, more so than any other country in that particular type of oil. They should be a fabulously wealthy country, and they were. The problem was that in 1999, I believe it was, they elected Hugo Chavez to be their president. Now, Hugo Chavez was a hardline Marxist. He was a revolutionary. And he was actually beloved of the Australian Labor Party, by the way. The president of the Australian Labor Party, Warren Mundine, in 2007, signed an invitation, a joint invitation along with a bunch of other sitting Labor Party MPs and academics to invite Hugo Chavez to come on a speaking tour in Australia.
Just a quick explanation of a Marxist, because okay. I think Kamala Harris's dad was a Marxist as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, absolutely. So and Barack Obama listed as his mentor, someone who is an avowed Marxist, a known Marxist. So Karl Marx, obviously a political theorist, mooched off his rich friend's dad for his entire life. So he lived like a Marxist. He just, you know, he really lived out his values. He was an absolute burden on everybody. He essentially viewed capital as the enemy. He viewed production and the person who's working, the person who's putting in the hours, as where wealth comes from. He gave no real value to the organization of production. He gave no real value to the entrepreneurial aspect of having an idea, seeing a need, meeting a need. He placed no value on any of that. All of his value, in his opinion, all the value was created by the workers. So he viewed any wealthy non-worker as an exploiter. Anyone that could organize workers in a way that made more money and therefore made them rich, anyone that built up capital, was an enemy of the worker. His view was that if we just eat the rich, if we kill the capitalists and confiscate all the capital from them and redistribute it amongst the workers, we're going to create a workers' paradise where the capital belongs to them.
Kind of what you're seeing from Bernie Sanders, AOC.
All that stuff. That kind of stuff. All of what's happening in South Africa right now with the confiscation of the farms there, what happened in Zimbabwe under Robert Mugabe, what happened in Argentina, although they've just their story might have a happy ending, a rare thing, but we're watching a change there. And it's what happened in Venezuela. So Hugo Chavez came in and he immediately ramped up welfare. This is the first thing to look out for. Now, in the 1950s, there was a book published by a couple, Cloward and Piven, and it's known as the Cloward-Piven strategy. It was they were revolutionaries or radicals, as they were known at the time. And their ambition was to collapse capitalism so as to introduce Marxism. They wanted a full Marxist, a communist country. They wanted America to be a communist country. Their strategy was very simple. Increase welfare to the point that it's unsustainable and it collapses the whole economy. And then use the chaos that ensues to say, capitalism has failed, we need Marxism. That's their strategy, that's their plan. And so the first thing that Nicolas Maduro did was he ramped up welfare to completely unsustainable levels. And there's two things you have to do. If you're from his point of view, from the Cloud Piven strategy point of view, there's two things you have to do. You have to make sure that there are more people on the teat than not so that they can never vote you out. Once you've crossed that threshold where 50% of the voting public depend on that welfare to make ends meet on a week-to-week or month-to-month basis, you're in. You're never getting kicked out again. And you have to ramp it up to the point where it's costing so much money that it's not sustainable economically. It will lead to a collapse of the economy because that's the cover by which you introduce your Marxism. Have we reached those?
Very similar to things we've seen play out.
Well, here in Australia, I did the maths 10 years ago, and it's gotten worse since then. If you add up everyone that depends on government money, it's more than 50% of Australian households. Now, I want to be clear about this. That's not depending on government welfare. That's depending on government money. That includes people whose salaries are government-funded salaries. But it also includes welfare and payments and yes. People whose businesses rely on government contracts.
NDIS. Pretty much
NDIS now is ramping that up massively. If you run a business, you're in the private sector, sure, but if your only client is government...
And what that effectively does is give more control to government
any
rather than less, right?
Yeah.
You know, capitalism, while not perfect, has been the most successful system throughout history.
Capitalism.
And that puts control in private.
Yeah, correct. Hands. Capitalism corrects itself better. Capitalism makes market more forces. Mistakes, yep. Makes more mistakes because there's more decisions being made. But the consequences of those of a bad decision rests on the person who made the bad decision, and that makes it very quickly self-correcting. The problem with Marxism is its central planning. There are fewer decisions being made, so there are fewer mistakes. It can actually work for a while. People point to Nordic countries, so they've got massive welfare states. They're like, oh, well, that's working well. Mm. Now, they also happen to have a very unregulated productive sector as well. That's why they can afford that for a time. But ultimately, when mistakes get made, two things happen. Number one, the mistake is across the board. It's everywhere. And so there's no comparison possible. Mm. If you make a great business decision and I make a bad one, people can compare the pair and go, right, that's a better decision. Mm. But if there's one decision being made applied to everybody, there's no comparison. And so you can't learn. But secondly, also, the person who makes the decision is pretty much the only person exempt from it. These bureaucrats that are on their six-figure salaries and in their ivory towers, they don't suffer the consequences. Mm. Even now, we're looking at them ramming through reforms to the superannuation tax, these unrealized
gains. Exactly. I mean, it's not doesn't affect the pollies.
Doesn't affect the pollies or the judges or the high-level bureaucrats.
They're going to put this thing through, but like the jab, they're going to be excluded.
Yeah, exactly.
The fuck?
Yeah, exactly.
So Marxism is central planning, and so when you push up welfare to the point that number one, it'll never get voted out, and number two, it will collapse the economy. That's the first sign. I would say we've already ticked that box here in Australia. We've crossed that threshold, and I think recent elections serve to demonstrate that. The second thing is price controls. Now, this happens largely because people's quality of life starts to drop because the cost of living gets so high because inflation gets out of control. Now, what the Venezuelan government did was it said there's a whole bunch of items that we're going to call human rights, bottled water, condoms, toilet paper, a whole bunch of stuff, and we're going to regulate the price. And that's going to stop people from price gouging because those evil, you know, Quickie Mart owners are price gouging everybody. And that's what the problem is. So they dictated what the price had to be. What they think is going to happen is that means the price will drop and people will be able to afford those items. In reality, what happens is, yeah, the shelf price drops. The business owner looks at it and goes, I'm going to lose money. If I restock, I'm going to be paying more to restock than I can sell it on the shelf. So I'm not going to restock. Okay. So the shelves go empty. Then what? So that's the real first order effect. The second order effect then is the first order effect is the prices drop. The second order effect is the shelves go empty because the response from shop owners is, oh, we're not going to restock. The third order effect is, well, people still need this stuff. So the black market steps in, which I actually consider the black market and the free market to be basically identical. If you did a Venn diagram, it'd be just about a perfect circle, right? So the free market steps in to meet this need. But of course, they are going to meet the need at a price point that is profitable. So we're back to the prices as they were before. Plus, they have to add danger money.
After the Cold War and before Russia collapsed, basically you had bread lines, lining up for bread, then bread was just like through the roof because of price control.
Yeah, and I believe it was Boris Yeltsin who came to America and he was genuinely blown away just by a regular supermarket. And his comment was, in America, the bread line's up for you, right? And in Russia, that wasn't the case. Now, we can talk about more economic theory and why that happens if you want, but I'd love to get through these five things.
Yeah. Mm.
Yep. So the second one is price controls, and they do that because the cost of living gets out of control. Well, I'm sorry, our cost of living is out of control. Our living standards are dropping because real wages are not keeping up, and we are beginning to see talk and murmurs around price controls. We are seeing price controls in the form of rental controls. That already exists. We're seeing price controls starting to enter some other sectors as well. We're seeing the promises of price controls around energy and electricity prices doesn't really materialize, but we're seeing it being promised. We're seeing supermarkets being demonized as price gouging. Mm. I did a video on this, by the way. For every $1 of profit the supermarkets make, guess how many dollars in taxes the government has taken from the supermarkets? Five. For every $1 of these price gouging supermarkets profits, there's $5 has been taken by various stages of government through various activities done by the supermarkets, right?
Yeah, it's the same thing with new house and land. Yep,
correct.
45% of purchase price is going through government.
Yep, correct. So price controls come in and we're already beginning to see that, right? The problem with price controls is as I've said, they have the effect of making things unavailable. So the other way that they do price controls is through subsidies. And they'll control the price, but rather than making the price come down, they'll subsidize the buyer. Mm. All right. And so what happens there, take, for example, childcare. Childcare is a heavily subsidized industry. Yep. Why is it always so scarce? No one can get a childcare spot, despite the fact that the government is throwing money at it. Well, no one can get a childcare spot because the government is throwing money at it. These things are one and the same. So what follows subsidies almost immediately is quotas. We're going to have to restrict how many days you can have childcare. Well, why do we need to restrict it? Well, because it's underpriced. So the market demand is not being held back, being restrained by the price signal.
It's not a true market.
Prices are a conversation. Money is a conversation more than anything else. It is a conversation that we have with each other 24/7 about what we want, what we need, what we prioritize, what's more useful to us than something else. And when you either control prices through direct price controls, through subsidies, through quotas, through any of these things, you are stunting that conversation and we can no longer communicate effectively about what we need and what we want. So quotas are the third thing. They come in on the back of subsidies. So the first thing is unsustainable welfare that applies to more than half the population. Then come price controls because the welfare drives inflation. People can't afford to live anymore. Price controls start coming in. Price controls distort the market and make quotas necessary. What are we seeing now? The government is stepping into the housing industry and saying, we're going to decide how many houses get built. We're going to fund it. We're going to do this and that. We're seeing quotas now. mark my words, within 3 years, during this term of government, the issue of people with unused bedrooms will be back on the front burner. The issue of, oh, retirees with their four-bedroom homes, with those three empty bedrooms, how dare they? That will be back on the table, and that's an issue of quotas. We're going to tell you how many bedrooms you're allowed to have before you have to start letting someone else in. Now, I'm not saying that'll become policy, but it'll be back in the conversation.
Well, it's happening in Canada right now.
Correct.
I'll give you an example.
My
grandmother, right? Grandpa, their government subsidy, came here literally poor, no money, rented their entire life. And they had a two-bedroom unit that was subsidized by the government. And all of a sudden, my grandpa dies, right? Elderly, 88, he passes away. Well, they've lived in this place for, I don't even know, 15, 20 years, the same apartment, same, right, little two-bedroom apartment. All of a sudden, there's a knock at the door that goes, sorry, but you can't live here anymore because you have a two-bedroom. You don't need a two-bedroom anymore. You live on your own. We're now going to place you in a different complex across the city where you know nobody, where all your friends in this building you're no longer going to have because she can't drive and she's never been able to drive. And now she's in a one-bedroom apartment because of the subsidy. And this is why these topics, right, for me are so important because they hit home. Like you're sitting there talking about a lot of these things and people are be like, wow, that's a lot of information. But the reality is that perfect example, right, has changed my grandmother's lifestyle, 86 years old, because she's left her hands, right, and she's left herself to the hands of government, right, because she didn't, you know, I guess have the opportunities or took the risks when she should have. And this is why it's so important and why we created Unemployable.
And it's like that, sort of going back to it, it doesn't affect me yet.
Correct.
And so that's that frog in the pot scenario.
Yeah.
Until you have a parent or a grandparent, and then it's like a little bit too late, right?
And this is the issue that we have here as well. And we spoke about it with Scott O'Neill, who came on the podcast, is because our property prices have gone up so much and because we have like one of the larger millennial cohorts in the Western world, a lot of millennials don't have a home. And these are the people that are going to be coming into power either through voting or through leadership. And they're going to be pro more of these kind of policies. Right. They're going to leave everyone high and dry because they're like, well, I got fucked. So
couldn't get in anyway.
And that thing that you said about how it doesn't affect me, and then by the time it does, it's too late. I mean, obviously, there's a famous Bonhoeffer quote first that came for the unionists, and I wasn't a unionist, so I said nothing, etc. And then by the time that came for me, there was no one left to speak for me. But it's actually simpler than that. It comes back to what I said earlier about the lag in our perception. Mm-hmm. Right, that's what we're talking about here. By the time we realize we're in trouble, we are 20 years beyond the window for action is closed. And that's why, to come back to what you asked earlier, why do I do what I do? Because the window for action is still open.
That was what was so incredible for me with the recent election in America, that we were on the precipice of the whole world tipping into this, I believe, if the other side had got up. And out of nowhere, this guy...
Yeah.
Who nearly gets shot, comes back from the dead and wins. And I feel like I'm more optimistic today because of that. I'm still worried about a lot of things in Australia, but I'm more optimistic because the whole Western world almost came so close to tipping over that edge.
Can I just say, we're up to number three. Let's do, can we do four and five? Because then I want to come back and go, what's your view on how to fix four and five?
What's up?
Just quickly on that, the other one that gives me hope is Javier Milei in Argentina. Because this is a country that was deep into basket case territory, a lot further down this spiral than what Australia is right now. And what it took was them to find the will.
Maloney in Italy.
Well, Maloney in Italy is probably a less dramatic example. Mm. What Javier Milei's done in Argentina is the most dramatic example in my lifetime of change
turning
in a good direction. Yeah. We've seen really dramatic examples of change in a bad direction. He's the most striking example of radical change in a good direction in my lifetime. So number four is nationalisation. This is where the government steps in and says, they don't say, but due to their price controls, due to their subsidies, and due to the distortions in the market that have led to quotas, they go, market failure. The free market's failed. The government is going to step in and we're going to nationalize these industries. Now, that's actually one of the first things that Hugo Chavez did because it fit with his ideology. He didn't wait for the alleged market failure. He jumped in, nationalized the oil industry, etc. in Venezuela. But what we're going to see increasingly here in Australia, and well, we're already beginning to see it. So in Victoria, they've relaunched the State Electricity Commission. So that's the government-owned electricity grid.
What does nationalize mean?
Yeah, good. Like, thank you.
Nationalizing an area.
So basically what it means is that the government now owns that industrial area. So for example, Telstra used to be Telecom and it was government owned and no one was allowed to compete with them. they had a monopoly on the telephone system. And the government said, well, that's because it's an essential service and we can only trust the government to provide it. But of course, anyone that knows anything about how the world works knows that that means it's going to be slow, it's going to be ineffective, it's going to be badly maintained, it's going to be hideously expensive.
Kind of like our broadband.
Well, they privatized Telstra and they allowed competition. In comes Optus and Vodafone and so forth. And now we've got a much more dynamic landscape. Then what did the government do when it came to, and this was the Liberal, this was Turnbull. The Liberal government goes...
The biggest disappointment in Liberal history.
He was the best Prime Minister the Labor Party ever had.
Yes.
You know? he comes in and says, right, we need a national broadband network. So he nationalized broadband and said, right, we're going to be the exclusive providers of fiber, of high-speed landline broadband. The only competition that's allowed is going to be 4G, 5G, and then ultimately Starlink, which of course wasn't envisaged 12 or so years ago when they started down this NBN nonsense, or it might have been however long it was. But even back then, despite not knowing that Starlink was going to come along, you can find my posts and my videos on the topic saying, by the time the NBN is rolled out, it will already be obsolete. Mm. And it's true.
And it still doesn't work anyway.
It still doesn't work properly.
It's a fucking pain in the ass.
I've got a neighbor on Starlink who is paying one third of what I'm stuck on a contract now, and to only for a few more months, and then believe me, I'm getting out. His internet is faster. And he's paying one.
You should be out already, mate. You should let that contract go, and you should just be out and
just be out.
break the laws.
No. See, when you sign a contract, that's an agreement that you've made. Yes. That's not a law that's being imposed on you. That's a different thing.
Yes.
And I go into detail in this in the book because what I'm not saying is good people do whatever they want.
Yeah. Good. So sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Good people screw people over. Yeah. No. You can break bad laws.
Yeah.
That's a different thing. But back to the five things. So nationalization.
Yeah.
We're seeing it. We've seen it with broadband. We're watching it happen with electricity.
Is houses nationalization where the government owns half of the house with you?
We're watching housing. Partial nationalization. But also nationalization doesn't actually require ownership. This is the difference between communism and fascism. People want to believe it's that control. They're opposites, right? Communism says the government should own and control the means of production. Fascism says the government should control the means of production, because if you control it, who cares who owns it? It doesn't matter. You just get them in your pocket. So what we're seeing actually through regulation is the de facto nationalization of industries. Once someone's not setting their own prices or their own production and they're making their own business choices, once they're spending more energy satisfying bureaucrats than they are satisfying customers, you have a form of fascism, a soft form of fascism that I would refer to as corporatism. Right. And that's where we already are. So nationalization, both through ownership, i.e. NBN, SEC in Victoria, but also nationalization through regulation, the fascist style of nationalization.
And if we relate it back to Venezuela, what are some of the things they have nationalized?
Pretty much everything. So
have they done food?
So not quite. They never nationalized food production, but they, in a sense, they did because they were controlling all the prices, which is de facto nationalization. I mean, ultimately, a bureaucrat is now making all
the decisions. And this is the perfect example.
You don't need to own it. Correct. You just need to control it.
Is it purely a political choice, or is it result of debt burden as well? Because you're starting to see some forms of this in the US, yep. Right? With the drug prices, you know, they may nationalize Freddie and Fannie.
Mm-hmm. So drug prices in the US is a great example of government creating a problem and then saying that more government is the solution. Why can drug companies extort their customers? I'm no fan of drug companies. They're the biggest criminal cartels in the world, and that's not my opinion. They have, as companies, paid the largest criminal fines in history. So it is the legal systems, the justice system's opinion that these are the biggest criminal organizations on earth right now. I am no fan of theirs. But how have they gotten away with extorting their customers? Well, because the government allows them to get special rules and special treatment. Allows them, whether it's through patents and intellectual property protection, different topic for another time, but whether that's through indemnity. Being able to sell a product and not be liable for what that may or may not do to people. And various other sort of government programs, the government in Australia here, the no jab, no play policy applying to kids and childcare centers. Well, that's essentially just turned the vaccine industry into a cartel. Mm. This is a protection racket now, a government-run protection racket. Taxis were a government-run protection racket. And eventually Uber broke that protection racket, right? So all around us, and when we actually stop and see it, it's one of those horrible moments where once you see it, you can't unsee it. You can't go back into the matrix, so to speak, once you see how the world really works around you. So nationalization is happening all around us. It's happening in Australia. It is happening in America. However, it's a little bit different in the sense that when the government is when the government is the problem in the first place, I kind of throw my hands up in the air when they go, yeah, well, we'll fix this by telling them what their price is. Oh, stuff yous all. A pox on all of your houses, the government and the drug companies that have been killing people and profiting off it for decades. I just, ugh. That's a horrible situation that's unfolding there. I was hopeful that we would see radical deregulation as opposed to increased regulation over new aspects of that industry. But anyway, so nationalization. And the last one, which hasn't, this is the only one that isn't happening yet. But when you see this, it's time to go and join your buddy in Cyprus. Because this is the warning. Capital controls.
Well, they're being talked about.
They are being talked about. So capital controls take many forms. There can be actual restrictions. Oh, you can't take your money out of the country, etc. Well, we're already being told we can't take our money out of the bank. You want to buy crypto? You want to just get some cash just to have on hand? These sorts of things. Well, you'd better explain to us exactly what you're doing with this money. Thank you very much. But capital controls in Venezuela took the form of government-controlled exchange rates. Government-controlled interest rates, obviously, we already have. That's a form of capital control and certainly a form of nationalization of money. But in the form of controlled exchange rates. So if I tapped my card in Venezuela and bought something over the counter, it would exchange the US dollars that my card was in to bolivars at 4-1. But if I went to a black market or a real market cash exchanger, they would change it at 250-1. Right? That was the spread. And then the government had multiple different official rates in between. Now, you guys are all business people. You can already see the opportunity. If there are radically different exchange rates, arbitrage, right? Bring it in this way, send it out that way, keep the difference, right? Well, that's where quotas come in and controls come in, where that's the rate, but you can't just access that whenever you want to. You're going to be told how much of that you can get or whether you can get it. One of the most striking things in Venezuela was walking through their shopping centers. And remember, this is a place that had money. Some of these shopping centers and things are beautiful. They're lovely. You walk through and there's a shop, fully stocked shelves. And you know that the owner of that store or that chain of stores has connections politically because they're able to sell things in bolivars and then exchange their money out to import new clothing or whatever it is into US dollars at an exchange rate that they can still actually use. But that's not the black market exchange rate. Then next door, so the most striking example was a Furla store. And if you don't know what Furla is, your wife or girlfriend will, okay? High-end fashion design, etc. There's an entire store there. I've got a photograph of it. They had three pairs of sunglasses and one handbag, and that's all they had on the shelves. And you know that the owners of that store did not have the connections. And here's the problem. If they shut the store down, they get thrown in prison by the government because the government has said there is a capitalist plot to make the government look bad. So anyone that goes out of business, you are a part of that plot and you go to prison. So there's an attendant sitting at the back of this store that has zero chance of ever selling anything. And the owners of that store have to keep losing money, keeping that store open because that's the ransom they pay to not go to prison. And that's the reality of capital controls. Once they start controlling the interest rates or the exchange rates, excuse me, that you can get changing your money in and out. The moment you see active capital controls, restrictions on capital flight, these sorts of things, I would suggest you want to be ringing up your buddy in Cyprus.
Can I just say for everyone out there, for myself as well, you've given us the 5 points of Marxism, capitalism, or communism.
Well, I'll say specifically the 5 points that I observed at work in Venezuela, and I'm using as my way markers in Australia.
So just to put a ribbon around it, what's the ultimate upside for the people who are implementing this stuff?
So a lot of it is they actually believe it works.
Right, so they're not power-hungry like Putin, is it?
I would suggest that anyone that wants to be in public life has some degree of power-hungry something about them to one degree or another. But these people, what makes them so dangerous, in the words of the author who wrote Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive because the tyrant oppresses with the approval of their conscience.
Mm.
And that's actually the situation that happens here. These people, you know, Robert Mugabe, I don't believe, thought that he was going in there to destroy Rhodesia or Zimbabwe as it became. He went in there to bring justice and prosperity to my people. And then a whole bunch of them starved to death after they shot each other for a while. The same thing's happening in South Africa. The same thing's when Hugo Chavez came in Venezuela, it was not his intention to take them from the richest country in South America to being in the poorest countries in the world. That's not what he had in mind. He sincerely believed that he was going to lead them into a new and prosperous future. Karl Marx believed that his ideas worked.
There's an argument to be made that the Trump doesn't matter, the political party in Australia doesn't really matter, that the reason that we're going through what we're currently going through is because of the stage we are in the historical cycle, right? That these people are just figures of the stage that we are currently going through. If you've read The Fourth Turning, that kind of stuff, right? And it's like, and the thing that leads to these changes is equality and the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And then those things lead to the wealth inequalities, and then they lead to these policies. And it's just something that happens as part of the times.
So there is some truth in there, but there is also a very, very deep lie in there. And that is the poor are not getting poorer. By every single metric, the poor, you would rather be a poor person.
It's just the wealth disparity.
So what you're saying is the increase in welfare is making it a lot easier for them.
No.
So the
increase in global prosperity.
Yeah.
If you had to pick a moment in time to be poor.
Oh, I understand. Like, yeah.
The gap between the rich and the poor is getting greater, but the poor are not getting poorer.
Like, you're not going to die of starvation in Australia.
Not in Australia. Yeah. And increasingly not in the rest of the world. There's still more work to be done. I'm not dismissing that. But the progress that's been made in the last 40 years on global poverty is just astonishing. And if you, and this has been studied. So an American university studied. They went and asked a whole bunch of university students or college students in America, would you want to swap with John D. Rockefeller when he was the richest man in the world? And I'm like, yeah.
Didn't even have a fridge.
Hell yeah, of course I would. Okay, just hold that thought. Let's go through how he lived. Let's go through the practical realities of his life, how he traveled, how he communicated, what he ate, what medicines. You know, if he got a hangover, there was no Panadol. Right. And you go through all of that, and something like 96 or 98 or something percent of people change their minds, having actually gone through the details and said,
And the other four were those sociopathic artery ones.
You just want to have the relative wealth. I don't care about the absolute. And that's what the politics of envy appeals to, is that sociopathic element of, yeah, but he's got so much more. And because our experience of life is relative, if we're the poorest person we know, we're poor.
Mm.
The fact that we are historically incredibly rich, it doesn't make a difference because we didn't meet those people.
We speak about this on the pod all the time. It's like the false pie fallacy. It's like that there's less of the pie. There's never been more of the pie to go around.
Correct. And it's never been easier to change class. People who believe in sort of the class warfare and social mobility is the measure that they talk about, of people moving from, let's say, the lowest quintile of incomes through to, a middle one or up into a high one. The mobility, the ability to move between those has never been greater. And also, I want to knock another fallacy on the head. There's this idea that people have really brought back intersectionalism and the idea that some groups are oppressed, whether it's because of their color or their sexuality or their whatever
gender.
It may be, their gender, etc. These people are oppressed. Well, you know what liberated black people commercially more than anything else in America before segregation was ended? Was the Sears catalog. You know why? Because that piece of paper, when you wrote on it what you wanted, doesn't know what color you are. Right.
For those of you guys that don't know what a Sears catalog is.
Sears
was one of the biggest department stores in North America. The reason why I know this is way back in the day, I used to work at a Sears.
At David Jones Remiers.
Yeah, but on steroids.
On steroids. Yeah.
Like triple the size that eventually went to nothing, and they're all gone now.
So it used to be that, particularly in the South, but throughout America, obviously segregation was pretty deeply entrenched. And for example, whilst on paper a black person might be allowed to own a gun, there wasn't a gun store they could walk into and buy one because they'd get chased out by the owners of the gun store. No, you can't shop here, right? Sears catalog comes along, they can tick a box and have a minigun delivered to their house. Right. And that completely liberated black people in a way as a technology, mail order catalogs opened up the world for those people who were oppressed. The laws hadn't changed.
Same thing today. It's just the internet or social
when
media.
When you shop on an online shop, do you know the sexuality of the person who owns the store or the color of their skin or their political views? Do you care? just give me the product, the best product at the best price, deliver it on time like you promised, and we're good.
It's that time of year again at Unemployable, where we're opening up our Unemployable Business Coaching Program. It's over a 12-month period, and with that, you get private one-on-one coaching, group coaching, as well as private and live events throughout the year. You could get private coaching with me, and not only me, but our panel of experts that we have put together. These panel of experts have been in our network and are the exact people that we use in our business successes. People from branding, sales, marketing, our lawyers, our accountants, everyone that has helped build our businesses, you have access to. If this sounds of interest, go to www.unemployable.com.au/coaching and register your interest to see if it's a fit for you and us. Hope to see you there.
There has never been more opportunity in the world, even for the oppressed minorities today. So we live in quite frankly, the best time that there has ever been to be alive. And the greatest risk to us is governments stuffing it up, sincerely believing that they know better, sincerely believing we can bring a new era of prosperity and paradise for you all.
So that's put a nice ribbon around the upside to it from a perspective. So if we were to go back through the same five now and go, what's your answer to 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in your view to rectify this? It should be not what it'll be the frog in the pot.
So the vast majority of it is solved by the people just giving the government the middle finger and saying, no, you're not touching that, right? Price controls, no, F off. Can I swear on this podcast?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, this is a sweary podcast. Okay, we actually need to find our fuck off. And we need to direct it towards the government on all of those areas. But the trickiest one is the welfare, because people want the free money. They want the easy money. And this is why governments promise to fix things like housing affordability. But actually, they don't want to fix housing affordability, because if they did, then you wouldn't be as dependent on that.
It's just so contradicting, though, because, you know, people want the free money, right? Yet we don't want the immigration for qualified, you know, people.
Yep.
Because if you're giving free money, what's the incentive?
Correct.
People to get qualified and upskill.
Yep.
There isn't any.
Yeah.
But then we have all this immigration that's coming in that is, you know, whether, you know, people believe it's pushing up prices of real estate and the rest of it. And I want to ask you a few questions around that. Mm. But a lot of those same people are the ones that are actually complaining. Like it's so contradicting.
Yeah. It's not an internally consistent worldview. It contradicts itself. But so first and foremost, we need to find our fuck off and get the government out of welfare, get the government out of price controls, quotas, subsidies. All of that has to go. I don't care how well-meaning a given program is, it has to go. And that's going to cause a lot of upheaval. And this is why the Javier Milei's of this world, the recently elected new president of Argentina, he was elected late in 2023, December 2023. Within a month or two of him coming to power, he had halved the size of the federal government.
What makes me so pessimistic about what you've just proposed as the way to get through that is that in order for Australians to find their fuck off, we have to experience enough pain.
Correct.
And being the lucky country,
correct,
she'd be right, mate. We haven't nowhere near experienced enough of the pain that we need to get to the point where we say, no, fuck off.
So I don't want to keep going back to COVID, but I'm going to go back to COVID. After the police.
It was great to sit in your backyard and get paid to drink beer, wasn't it? I mean, the only shops are open, bottle shops and
brothels. Don't forget the brothels. You know, they were open too.
Essential services.
Yeah, essential services. Services with the emphasis on that. But we had the largest protests in Victoria's history right at the very end in late 2021 when Victoria Police finally backed off and did what they should have done at the start, which was just facilitate the protests rather than trying to crack heads. All of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of people came out, and we've got the footage to prove it. There were hundreds of thousands of people there, the largest political protest, bigger than anything that happened during the Vietnam War. Then we got to election time, and only a relatively small proportion of the people that showed up to protest actually voted for the Libertarian Party, then the Liberal Democratic Party, which was the only political party that actually stood up against the madness. So unfortunately, that reinforces your point. If Daniel Andrews gets re-elected with an increased majority, if Albanese gets re-elected, I mean, sure, Dutton ran one of the worst campaigns I've ever seen and was a completely uninspiring leader, and there's all kinds of issues there. But we went back to that. And unfortunately, you know, if I'm right that the limit of government power is defined by the limits of our obedience, that doesn't speak well of the future of Australia, because we are nowhere near finding the limit of our obedience. People like me are outliers in the most extreme sense.
So you're considering leaving Australia?
I considered taking my family to Mexico, Caribbean coast of Mexico. We decided instead to just move out of Victoria and stay in Australia.
Same outcome.
Here so far. We've moved from Victoria to New South Wales.
So let me put it to you this way. I am very, very focused. So my family comes first, and I make no secret about this with my followers. I'll do everything I can. I'll fight, but I'm not staying in Australia and going down with the ship. If I leave Australia, I'll keep fighting for Australia, but I'll fight from somewhere else where I'm not in range of, you know, I'm not subject to the combat, so to speak. So I'm at the point now where, I earn all my money online. I could live on a yacht if I could afford one. The only thing stopping me from living on a yacht is that I can't buy one. But I earn all my money on the internet now. I produce videos. I produce content. People buy my merch. They buy my books. I write books. I can sit on a beach and write a book. I don't have to be in Australia anymore. I choose to be here, except for the reality that I'm not financially in a position where I can move just yet. But my ambition and my mission right now is to get to the point where within 2 years, we are genuinely viable anywhere in the world.
So is the message for people watching at home, and this is something that I probably already believe, but is the message that if there's limited things that we can do, if we're contrarian to the crowd and the majority is still, we're still in the minority, is the key to becoming unbreakable, becoming indestructible, the use of technology? Like is technology the thing out there, knowledge and technology the thing out there that can set you free?
Technology allows decentralization. Decentralization allows jurisdictional competition. Let me take you through that. It's an important framework to understand. It used to be that if you wanted electricity, you had to move to a big city. If you wanted the basics of technology, you had to move to a big city. Clean running water, electricity, sewerage, a community of people to buy from and to sell to, opportunity. You had to be physically proximate within one of these large metropolises. Technology has now, and so centralization was the order of the day. If you wanted to get rich, you had to go to New York, go to the Big Apple, right? That's where the real opportunity, that's where the real money is. And that's been true for decades. Actually, it's been true for a couple of centuries now, and arguably has been true for all of human history, in fact. That is changing, and it's one of the biggest unseen changes, in my opinion. You can now, or someone like me, and I'm sure most of you, could now live on a yacht off the coast or in a rural property somewhere or wherever you felt like it, from a caravan doing a lap of Australia. And thanks to Starlink, and thanks to solar panels and on-site batteries and maybe a small diesel generator, etc., you are able to decentralize. You no longer have to crowd yourself into that same metropolis in order to access those opportunities. So technology has now allowed decentralization, arguably for the first time in human history. Decentralization without loss of opportunity, arguably for the first time in human history. Now, what that then allows is two things to happen. Number one, nations used to get rewarded for getting bigger. Cities got rewarded for getting bigger. The more people you had, the more crowded you got, the more clout you had on the global stage. The second order effect of technology allowing decentralization is that actually the concentration is going to cease to be an asset. Urban blight, I think, is going to become a much bigger problem in Australia. We see it already in America, where the downtown areas are no-go zones. We're seeing that beginning to creep in increasingly here in Australia, and I think that's going to become a bigger problem, because where it used to be that the closer you got to the middle, the more money there was, well, now people are sick of that lifestyle. They can make just as much money somewhere else, and we're going to see them relocating, and it's going to be the dependents that are staying where the services are. Right, this is going to be those people. So we're going to see a reversal of that relationship. But also, a country doesn't have to be so big. I'm an advocate for creating more states in Australia. I'm all about let's split up Queensland, North Queensland, and Southeast Queensland. The whole Murray River, the whole Murray-Darling Basin needs to be split off as a riverina state. We need West Australia to break up into a couple of states. We need a lot more states in Australia. And it was originally envisaged by the guys that wrote our constitution. They never thought we would stick with what we've got now. That's crazy to them. Our population has increased by however much it has. And we're still stuck with the exact same monolithic states. Victoria is run by Melbourne and Geelong. New South Wales, you know what New South Wales NSW actually stands for? Newcastle, Sydney, Wollongong. Because that's what runs the entire state of New South Wales. So what we've got, thanks to technology enabling decentralization, we have an opportunity to break existing jurisdictions up into smaller units without necessarily a loss of clout and opportunity. But if that's not going to happen, if we can't get the will to do that, it allows those with the will to choose the jurisdiction they go to.
Mm.
And that's a radical, radical change now. To be able to change jurisdiction without loss of opportunity is something that has only become possible in the last 15 or so years. And about 12 years ago, I started following the Nomad Capitalist. We mentioned him before, Andrew Henderson. And this isn't this wasn't his idea, but he's packaged these ideas up really well and he communicates them really well. And so, yes, the next couple of years of my life, I'm going to be working on second passports, moving potentially my business interests overseas, etc. All above board, all completely legal, all completely transparent. I can go to the tax office and say, here's exactly what I've done. Right. There's nothing cloak and dagger about any of it, but it allows me to move my life or the parts of my life that I don't want under Australian jurisdiction into other jurisdictions.
There's a great book that was written some years ago that kind of predicted all of this, and it's called The Sovereign Individual.
Yes.
So if anyone's interested in kind of understanding why it's happening and the background to it, check out that book.
I want to touch base a little bit. We talked a little bit about economics and I want to come back to that if we have some time just around real estate.
Okay.
But you had four things, right? We talked about limits of government power. We talked a bit about economics. You've got a third one here, the need for return of in-person community.
Okay. And this is going to sound like a contradiction to what I was just talking about with the online opportunity, et cetera. AI is driving a really, really interesting change in the world where in literally only a few years' time, it will no longer be possible to be certain that you are actually engaging with a human being, even when you're having a real-time video conversation with them on Zoom or IMS.
I thought about this too, unless you're in the physical.
Correct. And what's going to happen, the world is already dividing. The youngest generation now, the up-and-comers now in their teens, we're actually watching this really interesting radical split. And there's a lot of data to back this up. Some of them are going down the full woke, blue hair, all that stuff. But actually, every culture breeds its own counterculture, and the revolution always eats its own children. It's my sort of my theory of social change. We can touch on that later if you'd like to. But every culture breeds its own counterculture, and we've had the post-sexual revolution culture since the late 1960s. And that has now bred a very, very powerful counterculture that is splitting that generation. And a lot of them are actually now planning to get married younger, have more kids, get trades or get skills and get, you know, be useful in the world. Because they're watching the consequences of the post-sexual revolution world on their parents and their grandparents. And they're looking at it going, your lives are train wrecks. I don't want to be any of you when I'm your age. And so they're saying, well, what worked? Well, if we go back far enough, we find something that worked. And this is also, we're seeing this in a rise in a lot of the more traditional church denominations and so forth. Where, you know, a lot of people are going back to tradition, back deeper into history. So what's going to happen in that generation is some of them will completely embrace the AI world, the metaverse, so to speak. They will completely embrace that. They will happily live in that. They will be whatever kind of a slob they are in the real world, but boy, do they look good inside the metaverse, and they're making money in there and they're doing their, the more of their life they can spend inside that thing, the better. Then there's going to be the other half that, broadly speaking, are going to view that as a tool, the same way you and I would view Facebook or having a website or the online world. It's a tool as a part of your life. But it will become an increasingly detached tool. It will become its own world. And so they will actually have a greater desire, I think, than even our generation does for real face-to-face contact, because it's the only thing that you can be sure is real, is one when you're actually standing there talking to the person face-to-face. And I think what we're going to see is actually a resurgence towards local pubs, local gaming clubs and communities, you know, board gaming and card gaming, you know, men's clubs, not in the modernized sexual services sense of the expression, but, you know, men's gentlemen's clubs, churches are going to definitely be a beneficiary of this move. And we're going to see a really entrenched desire for real physical face-to-face communication. Now, the only thing that's going to save the AI side of things is blockchain authentication. It's the one, you know, the use of blockchain to actually be able to be certain that you really are talking to the person that they say that they are. At the moment, we use someone's face. We use someone's voice. Already, you can't rely on someone's voice. If you get a phone call from an unrecognized number and it's a familiar person saying, I was traveling and I lost my phone and I need money and blah, 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 it ain't them. I don't care how authentic it sounds. This is a scam that already exists.
Yep.
People are already losing money to this. We are 2, maybe 3 years away from it being their face on a video call, and it will be just as real. The only way to then authenticate anything online is going to be through a trusted blockchain-driven authentication. That'll become the only way to actually do that. But I think the reality is we're going to see a lot more people craving real, in-person, face-to-face connection, because so much will be offered in this digital world that'll be so fancy and so appealing and so tantalizing. It's just that dopamine high will become so overwhelming that it actually becomes numbing.
I'm seeing it with myself and my kids, you know, just on social media or on YouTube and stuff like that. Like half of this stuff now is AI. Like it's not real.
Yeah.
I can tell.
Yeah.
But someone that's 12, 13, 14, 15 years old can't tell.
Yeah.
At the moment, right? Like I remember talking about this on the pod 6-12 months ago. Oh, it's not great. It's not great. Now it's amazing.
Yeah.
Or is it going to be in another 12 to 18 months, right? So, and I'm a big believer in that as well. I think, you know, moving forward, you know, in-house events, you know, it will be something that will be craved by a lot of people because, again, on this online world, you don't know what's real or what's not.
And I don't know if you guys touched on it earlier, because I just went to the bathroom quickly, but if robots and all the jobs that we used to do are being done for us, you know, the natural inclination is going to be to seek contact again, right?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely going to be that. I want to address the issue of Luddites very briefly. If we've touched on that. There are people saying, oh, AI is going to take all of our jobs. Well, steam power took a lot of the jobs that existed back then. You know, mechanized agriculture destroyed an enormous amount of employment. It used to be that I believe it was about 90%+ of the population was involved in, as a full-time occupation, was involved in making food to feed the 100% of the population. So it took about 0.9 of a human being's life to feed one human being on average. And that was just the reality because they were hoeing by hand and planting by hand and watering by hand. And they didn't have all the technology that we have. Now it's about 7% of the population is directly engaged in food production. And so the Luddites would have you believe, the people that are saying, oh, the AI is going to take everyone's jobs. Then what are people going to do for a living? Well, what did all those people that used to grow food do for a living? Well, they became machine operators because the age of steam had come. They invented entire new industries and entire new ways of living. Lots more people now work in entertainment and content creation than ever before. Lots more people work fewer hours and pursue hobbies and passions and things like that than ever before. The same thing's going to happen here.
Do you have a view of what the jobs and industries of the future will be? Like if you had to predict?
I would suggest to you that the role of the entrepreneur will actually become easier, but more specialized. Let me try. This isn't something I've ever tried to articulate before. So let me see how I go. I apologize if it doesn't quite come out well. The role of the entrepreneur will remain exactly the same. The role of the entrepreneur is to observe needs and to meet them. It's as simple as that. And it's boiled down to its most basic form. But it won't be possible to compete without an understanding of how to use AI to do market research, to do, you know, content, to do funnel strategies with, you know, interacting with clients and customers, etc. There will be a skill set that will be needed that will involve AI, that will involve a much more elevated level of technology. But let me give you an existing reference for that. It used to be that for you to be a high-flying executive, you didn't have to know how to type. You had a secretary for that. The company had an entire typist pool of people that were employed because they had the skill of typing. Mm-hmm. You didn't need to drive because driving was a specialist occupation, right? There was a person who wore gloves and a suit and kept the car immaculately prepared, and you would open the door for you and you would sit in there and they would drive. Now, we can still do that today. The difference is we know how to get behind the wheel and operate that thing. Back then, it might as well have been an aeroplane, right? They didn't know how to do it. Now, we have integrated into our lives an enormous skill set that we don't observe. We don't notice that actually we are all machine operators. Mm. We are all drivers. We are all typists. We are all technologists. These are things that used to be discrete professions as these technologies emerged. The same thing's happening right now. We're all looking at AI going, oh goodness, you've got to be a specialist. You've got to there's people that just do this for a living. I better go and get a consultant. I better go and get a specialist. For the kids that are growing up with AI, that will be integrated into their knowledge pool.
I wonder if we go from big business back to small business, like you said.
Decentralization.
Yes, right? Like the 9-to-5 will disappear. Everybody, in essence, will be an entrepreneur. But instead of, you know, being an Elon Musk and trying to do all these global things, I run an e-commerce business and I have so many freelance guys that work for me and have like a handful of clients. Yeah. So we all become entrepreneurs that service a handful of people rather than monopolies.
So this is back to the technology enabling decentralization piece. Let me give you a more commerce-oriented example rather than a political jurisdiction-oriented example. The books that I just gave you guys, if I, as an author, wanted to write a book, how much I paid to get that book printed depended on how many copies I had printed. If I wanted to get a good price for the book, I have to do a run of at least 1,000, probably 10,000 before my price really starts to get good. Now, thanks to Amazon and the fact that their machines are completely digital, their machines do not care whether they're printing the same book as the last one or a completely different book. Mm. Do not care. Print, bind, cut, send it down the chute with the shipping label on it. It does not care. What that allows me to do is to print a single book at the same price I would pay if I got 10,000 through Amazon, right? So I, as the small business operator, benefit from the existence of the big business. Now, in clothing, there are machines where you put on a roll of fabric and it sucks that fabric in, cuts it, laser cuts it according to whatever the design is that it's been given, and sews it all the way around the edges and so forth, and spits out a completed garment, maybe with the neck still needing to be done, but by and large, a completed garment out of a single machine. At the moment, those machines still need to be set up the way that printers used to need to be set up. Oh, we're going to do a run of these t-shirts. That will not be true for very long. It'll be a very small amount of time. And I, as a clothing designer or a merch designer, could go, you know what, I want to change the cut of my design. And I could get a single one done and sent out, drop shipped out to a customer, manufactured on the spot for the same money as if I had done a run of 10,000 of them. So the technology is enabling decentralization, which will enable a return of small business. But actually what that's going to be, and this comes back to the technology piece and the integration of more skill sets, it's the entrepreneurs that can see the opportunities that are created by the existence of these technologies and these large businesses, the likes of the Amazons of this world, spotting that opportunity early.
And those large businesses largely become commoditized as well, right?
Correct.
And AI becomes commoditized. Yes. And then, you know, in essence, we've spoken a lot of negative things today, but in essence, the positive upside to all of this is that we continue to get more choice and our standard of living continues to increase in this world.
The future is going to be decided by who wins out of two forces, technology and commerce creating wealth, and government destroying it.
Well, I would say that we're no longer in a left versus right battle. We're in an accelerationist versus the decelerationist, or the ones who want to maintain the status quo.
And I've got to say, I'm leaning more accelerationist these days.
I'm all in accelerationist.
Let's explain the terms. So a reformer or a decelerationist says, hey, we can get back. We can recover from where we are back to something better. The accelerationist says, we're going to go to hell in a handbasket. So the sooner we do that, then the sooner we can rebuild out the other side of the collapse. Now, I've been a reformer. I've got to say, after this last federal election, I'm starting to think that maybe the accelerationists had a point.
Well, if you look at the US, right? Like you look at who was standing there in the inauguration, it was Bezos, it was Musk, it was Zuckerberg, it's David Sachs. It's all these people that are trying to accelerate towards the future.
Yeah.
One big thing though is people need to embrace it. Right, you need to embrace the technology. You can't be scared of it. But like I look at my parents,
yeah,
probably Mark's parents, maybe even James's parents, that haven't embraced technology. Yeah. I look at my grandmother.
Yeah,
I'll use her as an example again. She's never driven a car. Never. She's never had her driver's license. Right, and I look at that, and it just boggles my mind. Right, that you can actually live 86 years old, right, without driving a car. She never embraced that technology.
Yeah.
Right? I look at someone like my dad, right? He hasn't embraced technology. Mm. He doesn't know how to use a computer.
But will our kids...
And an email. And,
yeah.
Right? Will our kids ask the same question?
Ourself, yeah. Right? Myself. There's certain technologies I've embraced and there's other technologies I haven't embraced to a deeper level of learning, right? Yeah. Because it's generational, right? I think it'll just be the same thing. Like, where we can't just assume where we're going to be in 30 years from a technological perspective. Like it's mind-boggling to think that now I could just go, okay, Topher Field, okay, I got to find out a little bit about this guy. And I can get 1,000 questions within 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Where that would take someone days of research to do.
I use AI in the research for my videos all the time. But let's keep in mind, let's take a dose of humility when we look at the older generation. The rate of change is accelerating such that I can't, it's been a while since I've looked at it, but it's anticipated that by about 2030,
singularity,
we will be developing every year at a speed that used to take 40, 50 years. Yeah. Each year's change and the new technologies. Now, the thing that gives me hope with all of that is that we are moving into a time where technologies are much more readily made user-friendly.
Yeah.
I used to build computers back in the day, you know, PCs back, yeah. And you had to set the jumper switches on the back of the motherboard, yeah. And do all that stuff, right? You had to, if you wanted to overclock, you were changing the speed of the internal clock, and it changed the speed of the front side bus and changed everything all at once, and you couldn't separately control them. Now you buy the parts, plug them in, it recognizes what it's got and goes, oh yeah, hi, I'm here. Right. And so the good news is that these maturing technologies, these rapidly developing technologies will be already more mature from a user-friendly
point of view. User-friendly is a key. Like I remember, you know, I sort of got PTSD around, you know, setting up printers for your computer.
Gosh. Still have it.
Right. You literally need to call a consultant to set up your HP printer to your laptop back in the day. You know, now you have AirPrint and all these other things, and it's
and yet so still somehow freaking thing never works.
Yeah, my freaking still fucked up.
Honestly, I've literally taken a hammer to a printer before.
Yeah, I was
like out of frustration.
Man, I was in the bank yesterday doing a conference call because my mum was in Melbourne and I was in up here, obviously, and it took us fucking 45 minutes just to get the call working and the voice. And it's like, oh my God, like all these, obviously, because they're banks, they've got the internal systems, but some things are still backwards.
Couldn't we just use FaceTime?
Exactly.
Ding and it's done.
Yeah. No. I want to take the last, say, 10 to 15 minutes of this pod, unless you guys want to take it a different direction.
No, you go ahead.
And I want to take it back to a little bit of economics.
Sure.
And I want to talk a little bit about housing.
Yeah.
And,
and
the crisis that we're in today.
Mm.
I had a friend of mine, I posted, a video not long ago and it went viral, and it was, you know, if you're on 200 grand a year, you're not going to be able to afford a home. Mm-hmm. And then somebody sent me something of a mortgage broker yesterday, you know, with my little video up top going, listen to this, you know, internet fucking financial, you know, analyst talking about how you can't, you know, and he's like, $200,000 a year, you can fund $1 million property in regards to serviceability, right? And anyways, I messaged him and just said, hey, I think this would be a good debate. I'd love to talk about this. Is no, I'm good, thanks. All right, no worries. Yeah. But once you actually start calculating $200,000 and then you start calculating paying the tax on the $200,000, and then you start calculating the cost of living and rent and food and school fees and the rest of it, and you start seeing what you have left over that you can actually save after the car payments and the fuel and all the rest of it and the insurances, there's not much left over. One of the questions I have is, do you believe that the real estate crisis in Australia is a natural market failure, or is it a consequence of government interference?
100% government interference. I'll dive into that in a second, but let me throw a scary number at you.
Mm.
I did a video 10 odd years ago about the fact that more than half of a house, even back then, a new build, was actually government costs. If you take a fairly broad view of government cost, that's what it ended up being. I redid the numbers recently, and my question was, if I did a brand new build in New South Wales, which has the highest, or in Sydney specifically, which has the highest proportion of government costs currently, although Victoria are about to overtake them again with some of these new laws coming in. If I built a brand new $1 million home in New South Wales, in Sydney, and then I lived in it, so it's not an investment, it's my own home, and I paid it down to zero over 30 years, how much money would I have to have earned in order to have bought the proportion of the house that wasn't taxed to start with, right? So I'm left with a house that should only be worth less than $500,000, right, in today's money, ignoring the future value of money. I'm left with a house that's worth, you know, $500,000. How much have I had to earn? Turns out that $500,000 is only about 16% of what I would have had to have earned, because I'm paying the interest with pre-tax income. I'm also having to pay the interest on the part of the loan that I shouldn't have had to pay in the first place, because that was just taxes and cost of government in the first place. So your home, your own home, if you build your own home in New South Wales right now, live in it and pay it off over 30 years, it is going to be 84% tax. Oh, sorry, 84% tax. 16% of it will actually be will have gone into the value of the home that you own in the end. Now that will change,
including,
of course,
the interest and the compound interest.
Correct. And the fact that you had to pay tax on the money before you paid the interest, because the interest is not tax deductible, blah, blah, blah. You build it all in, that $1 million home costs you multiple millions, and you're left with something that should have only been $500,000 in the first place.
And then you've got inflation. But when you have, again, future price of money, but yeah. Sure.
We speak about this all the time, and we post the clips of, I think Pauline was saying it, we've said it, and people go, oh, that's fucking bullshit. Yeah, that's not true. That's bullshit. But like, I used to work for a land developer for like 15 years. So I've seen the FISOs. And I can tell you with certainty that like an average size block of land used to be 400 square meters, 120,000. Yeah. I can tell you with certainty now that the average size block of land, the tax alone is over 120,000.
Correct.
And it's close to 45% of the total price of land. And it's government, it's contributions, it's locals, taxes. Yeah.
And then you add the Australian Building Standards.
And so it's a flywheel. It's a flywheel. And you've got we've spoken about how Peter Thiel says that if you bring a 10% increase to a city, that'll increase the housing prices by 50%.
Yeah.
So it's a flywheel that the government is perpetuating by bringing people into the country. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying we should stop doing this because a lot of our prosperity has come through property. A lot of Australia's prosperity has come through property and immigration and things like that. But maybe it's time to start looking at a more balanced economic system.
Well, let me come back to your question before we talk about what potential solutions might be. Is this a natural market failure or is this government failure? This is absolutely government failure. I'm old enough to remember when John Howard was going to save us all from the housing affordability crisis. Now, 20 years later, you might laugh at the idea that in 2005 we had a housing affordability crisis, but I assure you it was all over the media. It was being talked about at the highest levels of Canberra. We have a housing affordability crisis and young people aren't going to be able to afford a home. We would all love to go back to the prices that houses were 20 years ago, even factoring in inflation, just as a proportion of median income, just as a multiple of median income. If we could get back to that ratio, we would all love to jump back there right now, unless you've just bought a house and you're leveraged to the max. You don't want the price to drop. That's part of the problem. But we were talking about a housing affordability crisis 20 years ago, before immigration was anywhere near the level that it is today. And so I love Pauline. I got a lot of time for her. I love Malcolm Roberts. Got a lot of time for him. I love Senator Rennick. Got a lot of time for him. I've met these people. But they're all wrong on immigration being the cause of the housing crisis. They're all wrong. If we had had zero immigration, we would still have what we would call a housing crisis. Now, the prices would not be as high. It would not be as bad. But we would still, in the national media and in the highest levels of Canberra, be talking about a housing crisis, because we've actually done it to ourselves through exactly the mechanisms you were talking about, by making things artificially expensive through government mandates and requirements, building requirements, requiring every single house in Victoria to have wheelchair accessibility, $15,000. What proportion of houses will ever have someone in a wheelchair living in it? Well, relatively few. So therefore, actually, you have to say, well, to help one person in a wheelchair, we've had to build 30 houses wheelchair accessible. Well, all of a sudden, we're talking about $450,000 per house that actually gets used by a wheelchair accessible person. Could $450,000 have retrofitted that one house with a lot of money left over? Yeah, of course it could have. So we're using our money badly. We're talking $60,000 for a large home to meet 7-star energy ratings.
Yeah. I'm in that right now. So I just got in just before the rules and laws changed around that, but just on the glazing package would have increased my glazing package by 50%, which means that's built into the cost of the house, which means the end value of the house needs to be built in and it goes up. And these are the things I agree with that are...
This is a modern day window tax. Costs. So in the UK, they had a period of time where they were trying to tax rich people. So they were taxing the number of windows they had on their properties. And this is why if you go to England, you'll see houses to this day with windows built in that are bricked up. They would brick them up to reduce their tax bill. And so then the government had to bring in a law that said you can't have a bedroom without a window, because kids are getting rickets because they're sleeping in bedrooms that have no natural light in them at all at any time of the day, because people were trying to minimize their tax bills. This has effectively become a new window tax. My wife and I are building an investment property at the moment. We just had to reduce the size of some of the windows in order to get from a 6-point-something energy rating up to a 7. Energy rating, because we couldn't justify the cost of the film that you can put on the windows for an investment property, right? So now we've just reduced the amount of natural light coming into a property in order to meet the government's tax-driven or money-driven regulations. Anyway, let me introduce a concept, I'm sure it's a concept you guys are aware of. This is the single metric that I think is the most important one for us to measure in housing, in the entire economy, the cost of living, the cost of everything. And it is the gap between what someone costs their employer versus the spending power they actually get to use. This is the gap between those two. That is the single most important economic metric, and I'm not hearing anyone talking about it.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah.
One more time.
So the gap
is that almost like profit per employee?
No. Completely. I'll break it down. But it's the gap between what you cost your employer versus the purchasing power you get left with. So let's take somebody on a roughly median Australian full-time salary, $85,000 a year right now. That person has a package of $85,000 a year plus super. All right. But also on top of the superannuation, now there's also going to be payroll tax. And there's also some non-tax costs that are around employment law, et cetera. You've got to have the HR department and all the contract and all the other costs that kind of get added on top. So you've got payroll tax, you've got superannuation, you've got everything else. I'm just going to round that out to an even $100,000 by the time you've added all of that on. That's probably a slightly high measurement, but I'm going to round that out to about $100,000. But the person doesn't get $85,000 in spending power because they have to pay income tax out of their salary. That's going to drop them down to about $70,000. But even then, they don't have $70,000 in purchasing power because so much of what they purchase has an artificially inflated price due to direct taxes or indirect taxes. So every liter of petrol you buy, every cigarette, every bit of alcohol, if you move house, you're paying stamp duty. If you start to actually go through all the different taxes, and I've done this in a video, you find that actually from their 85% pre-tax salary, more than 50% of it is lost in the cost of government. By the time you've paid all your different little shitty licensing fees and charges, and you factor in the infrequent ones like stamp duty, which even renters are paying, whether they like it or not, they're repaying the landlord for the
stamp duty.
That's
the vicious flywheel of wanting that more welfare state, right?
So you started with $85,000 or so you thought, but actually you cost your employer, let's call it $95,000. $100 is excessive. Let's call it $95,000. But your purchasing power is $45,000 by the time it's all being eroded away. But every single business out there has to set their prices to recover your cost, which was $95,000. So you're on a $45,000 real income, actual purchasing power, trying to buy things that are being set to recover $95,000.
That's a powerful calculation.
Okay.
Yeah.
That gap is the single most important economic metric anywhere in the world. And that gap is getting larger and larger day by day, month by month. And until we recognize that and we crush that gap as small as possible, the problem will keep getting worse. And this is why pay rises don't help. This is why more welfare is not helping. This is why none of the things that are currently being done are helping, because they're not addressing what I believe is the single most important element.
Is the gap.
It's that gap.
And then how do you fix it?
Well, start by crushing the size. So Javier Milei, go and visit him. So he's the new incoming president of Argentina. I mentioned him earlier. He halved the size of government, fired 70,000 government employees, got rid of half of their departments, eradicated most of their welfare programs, and people screamed bloody murder. People screamed bloody murder. This is a country that already had a poverty rate of more than 40%, right? And that got worse because a whole bunch of government employees lost their jobs and went straight into poverty. A whole bunch of people that were on borderline poverty but were being kept out of it because of welfare programs went into poverty because the welfare program got ended. People screamed bloody murder. There were protests on the streets. But less than 3 months after he did that, the economy started growing. Foreign investment started to flow in. Businesses started to innovate and flourish. Now, so the poverty rate was well above 40% when he came in. It peaked above 50% because of his actions, because of his reforms. And the media were loving it over here. The few that actually talked about him at all were he's failing, he's the protests on the streets, this and the, this neoconservative, pathway, which is not at all libertarian and neocon are two very different things. But they love to throw these terms around. So it peaked at over 50%. But less than a year after he came in, it was below where it had started when he came in, and it's been falling ever since. The economy is growing. People are becoming more prosperous. But the poverty rates are falling.
Inflation's down.
Inflation's down. Malnutrition rate is falling quickly. Malnutrition in Venezuela, by the way, obviously Argentina, Venezuela, two very different places. Malnutrition in Venezuela is a massive problem. This is a country that on average has lost more than 8 kilograms of body weight per person because of their economy. So how do we come back from having a gap between what we cost our employers and what we actually get to spend that is actually more than half of what we cost our employers? Well, that's all the cost of government. All of that difference in between, that's the cost of government.
And that's the issue when government has so much sway, is they need to fund that sway in some way. Correct. And taxes is the way.
Hence Doge for the Elon went there with the first.
But
the
that didn't really work.
Well, well, here's the problem. They could cut $1 billion of spending a day for the entire year, and they would not have reduced spending by as much as it increased in the last year of Joe Biden's.
Yeah, the deficit's actually increased.
Right. So they have a gargantuan task. What Javier Milei did is not what Trump and Doge are doing.
They can't touch entitlements in the US, but that's what they really, those people will get killed on a real basis over time. They'll get inflated away, but they can't take an axe to it.
They need to, because it's an existential crisis for them.
Tovret, I'm going to wrap things up.
Sure.
Or else we're going to keep going and it's going to be 3 hours.
Yeah.
What's one thing that you would say to the audience, right? That average person that's on that 85,000, not being able to own a property, right? Cost of living is eating away at them. What would you say to them right now to try and make change in their life?
End it on a positive note.
Goodness. That's
in Australia, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like it could be follow my channel. It could be educate yourself around X. It could be, you know what? Learn about history, right? So I'm nowhere near the level that you would be at in regards to education around history.
So I basically packaged the answer to that question into my masterclass. And this is going to sound like I'm just taking a free kick to promote my shit. And yes, I guess in a way I am. But let me talk about what's in the masterclass. And that'll be the answer to the question. It's 6 weeks. The five main topics in the 6 week is a wrap up, pulling it all together. The five main topics are hope. Mm-hmm. Hope is an incredibly essential and powerful thing. But it's also a very dangerous thing, and people can misuse hope in order to lead people on and to get what they want out of people. We need to control our hope and know why we have it and where it comes from and what it's in. Focus. Now, this is probably the thing that I would leave with people today. Focus. You choose where you focus. You can't save the world. The reality is you probably can't change the world, right? But what you can do is choose where you invest your energy in the world. Every yes has a no attached to it. Every no has a yes attached to it. Those things that you think you want to do, but you don't have time for, it's not that you don't have time. It's that you said yes to something that should have been a lower priority. Mm. Change what you say yes to, start saying no to a lot more things, and you will open up the ability to say yes to the things that you know really matter, but you're not getting to, because I don't have time. Yes, you do. Start saying no a lot more. Shift your focus. For some people, that's going to mean stop spending so much focus on news and what's happening in the world and all the rest of it. Get out of your device and get back into real life and just start actually doing stuff. And then I talk about courage in the third week. I touched on that earlier, where it comes from. And we can actually, once we really drill down into what courage is and values and identity, we can actually start to control it and actually start to, we can begin to calculate if a given situation arises, will I or will I not have courage? And will the people around me have courage? And this is why, one of the reasons why we need to get back into community. We need to, something like COVID and the way the world is going right now, bad times give good people an opportunity to find each other. And what we need to do is to understand what courage is and make sure that we're surrounded by people that have similar values and similar identities that require them to act. And what that means is the next time something happens and we feel the need to stand up, we won't be alone. Because we'll be in a community of people that share our values and have the identity as a doer, someone who takes action. And when we feel that compulsion, my values are being violated and I need to do something about this, and we stand up, we look around and there's heads popping up all over the place. So courage is a huge one. And knowing what your values are, why they are, and having the identity that requires you to be a doer and do something about it. courage, then faith. Now, faith is not just in the religious sense. There are many, many reasons to have an enormous amount of faith in humanity. And I'm ridiculously optimistic for the future. I think we have to go through a really rough patch to get there. But I am ridiculously optimistic for the future, because look at history and look at what your ancestors, in the broadest sense, look at what humanity did and overcame. Look at the darkness that has been, and yet they came through to where we are today.
Yes. Right? I agree.
So faith. Then community, which is talking about this need to build that community and not just a community of people that know our name and we know theirs, but people whose needs we can meet, who can meet our needs, who share our values. Then in the sixth week, I get practical and I say, okay, let's talk about something that you can do right now that is going to change your relationship with how you live. And I won't mention his name, but you would know who he is. He's a prominent Australian businessman who we spoke during COVID. And he was feeling very, very trapped by the national border being shut down. And he discovered that actually, if your plane is six seats or less, you can leave. All the restrictions didn't apply to privately owned planes that were small. So he just bought himself a long range small plane that had the range to be able to get out to Pacific Islands and through Asia and so forth. He never felt the need to leave Australia after that because he knew he could. So taking some practical steps can completely change your relationship with your circumstances, even if it doesn't change your circumstances. And the practical steps that I advocate for people to take, something that everyone can do, is what I call my survive in place plan. And let me preface this. We are watching. We saw it in Spain the other day. Instability of the grid. London. The grid went down. The tube stopped. Our grid is becoming less and less stable. Storms. In Texas, there was a winter storm a couple of years ago, killed over 700 people, not because of the storm, but because the grid went down and people weren't ready for it. People weren't prepared. We are seeing around the world, if we had a Carrington event, 1854, I think it was, look it up. It'll scare the bejesus out of you if you don't know what it is. A solar flare, basically, which was so powerful back then that it was setting fire to the telegraph huts because the wires were acting as antenna and there was so much latent energy in the atmosphere that was sparking and setting fire to things. Imagine that in our modern world. What if the Earth copped one of those today? Right? What would that do to all of our devices, all of the devices that control all of our infrastructure, all the rest of it? I'm just trying to scare people. I'm just saying, look, I think politically the hour is later than we think it is, and we're closer to shortages and supply chain disruptions than we think we are. And I think technologically we're more vulnerable than we think we are. I can't change either of those realities. What I can change is my relationship to those realities. And I do that by having a 3-day survive in place plan that in theory means that if everything stopped, nothing in or out of the borders of my property, no water, no gas, no sewage going out, by the way, you got to think about sanitation, no electricity, no grocery runs, no neighbors, nothing. How long can I stay within the borders of my property discreetly surviving? Now, I was in Victoria when the lockdowns came in and the famous toilet paper shortage happened. And I've seen people get real savage over a roll of toilet paper. Just stop and think for a moment. If there was a genuine three-day disruption to food on the supermarket shelves, the minute the word got out, people would be gouging out each other's eyeballs in the local supermarket. Yeah. Now, again, I'm not trying to spread fear, but I think it needs to be said. We are closer to that knife's edge than I think we realize. Politically speaking, the hour is later than we think, and technologically, we're more vulnerable than we think. We need to be working on our food, our water, our sanitation, our energy. It's relatively inexpensive. You don't need a big Tesla battery on your wall. You can get these nice camping battery setups that'll run your fridge for a couple of days, right? That keep all your food from spoiling. You allow you to cook some food, boil some water, these sorts of things. And I'm not saying that you're going to need it, but I'm saying that having it is going to change your relationship with your circumstances. You are not going to have to be as edgy, as knife's edge of, oh, what's happening now? What's happening today? What, did someone say something? If you know you've got resilience, and what about 30 days of resilience instead of 3? If you knew you had resilience, you could actually breathe better and relax a lot more, and your relationship with your circumstances will improve. And so that's what I would say that I'm doing for my family and what I think we should all be doing.
Got to be interesting to see this younger generation coming through now that are 14 and 15 that have never even picked up a fucking shovel. Now they're digging a hole, putting shit in it. That would be interesting.
Yes.
So for this has been a very impactful interview. Again, thank you very much for you flew up here from New South Wales just to come to this interview, which we're very grateful for.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
What's the best way of people to get in contact with you?
Yeah, so follow me at Topherfield on all the socials. It's the same handle across all the socials. I am most active on YouTube these days, X and all the rest of it. I'm mostly just posting the links to my YouTube videos. That's what I'm doing. But
yeah,
I'll get back to X in a bit more of a serious way in coming months. I do have a website, Good People Break Bad Laws. That's where you can find my books. There's two, one about civil disobedience in the modern world, and the second book is about the theology of civil disobedience. So diving into the scripture and mounting the case for why I believe that Christians should be actually among the very first people to stand up against a government that it oversteps its God-given boundaries. I have a DVD of my award-winning documentary, Battleground Melbourne. You can also see that for free. Battlegroundmelbourne.com is just there. You can watch it. You don't have to give me an email address or anything. When I made that documentary, I had the privilege of being the storyteller, but it's not my story. That story was written by the people of Victoria and their courage in the face of Daniel Andrews. And so when I had the privilege of telling that story, I made a promise that I would keep it available for free online for as long as I could. And that's what I'm doing. So battlegroundmelbourne.com, you can watch it for free. But at any given point in time, with censorship laws and everything changing in Australia, that could get taken down. So if you wanted to get a copy of the DVD, you can do that from Good People Break Bad Laws, along with my books. And then I got my t-shirts, I got my my hoodies, etc. You mentioned earlier America and their sort of culture with guns and the American Revolution. I was wearing, and I took it off for this interview, but I was wearing when I got here my shirt that says, "Too much 1984, not enough 1776. And it's my favorite niche shirt. It's like one of these, if you know, you know, kind of shirts.
Yeah.
And I nearly wore it for this interview, but I didn't.
Topher. Gold. Thank you very much, James.
It's been
as usual. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks,
appreciate you coming every time, driving up from Byron Bay.
With my Tesla Powerwall.
In your Tesla car.
And again, to the audience, thank you very much for your attention. You know, and watching Unemployable. We're showing up every week for you guys to bring interesting people like Topher on and spreading some education around on things that you don't know. Please like, subscribe, comment, let us know what you like, let us know what you dislike, and who else you'd like to get on the podcast. And yeah, thank you again for your time. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you on the next one.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.